You're listening to The Daily Digestionalist with Matthew Heidmark at RadioArian.com.
Comrades, this is your host of The Daily Traditionalist, Matthew Heinbach, and I'm joined today on location with Dr. Matt Johnson. We're doing our traditionalist worker party Thanksgiving here this week, and Dr. Johnson was so amazing to be able to come out along with other comrades, where we're spending the week together not only getting work done, but also fellowshipping, and that's what it's all about. It's about treating one another like extended family, being extended family. So, Dr. Johnson, how are you doing today, and how's Southern Indiana treating you?
I really appreciate the fact I get to be at the command center. You know I rank around here. if I'm allowed to sit here, I'm like a little girl.
You know, at the command center next to my washer and my dryer. And
at a Justin Bieber concert, I feel like I'm going to start screaming at any moment.
Well, it's awesome to be able to have you here. And this is, I think, such an important opportunity. Again, to all my listeners, before we get into anything, be sure to be able to spend Thanksgiving. I know due to the current American economy, the way thing is, sometimes it's hard to be with family. You know, whether it's our politics or just distance, when it comes to the economy, money's tight for everyone and it's hard to get home for family. But I would encourage everyone to be able to get out with comrades, get to your Daily Stormer book club, see if there's some meetup just this week, if maybe you can't go home and visit family, and really make this special, because we need to remember, you know, all the Thanksgiving that we should be giving for what we've had just in the past year. I mean, you think about what's happened with our cause. You think about how things are pushing forward. The defeat of the globalists here with the election of Trump, with Brexit, with the things that are upcoming. There's so much to be joyful for. And I always want to keep things positive. And there's so much to be positive about. But it really is a time as we're coming to the end of 2016, the best damn current year there's ever been. it's really time to give thanks, because God has blessed us. He's blessed our movement, and we really need to give thanks to one another and to God for everything we've gotten. Dr. Johnson, what do you think on that?
I'm not going to be sarcastic anymore. I really mean it. This is absolutely true. This time last year, I hated anybody who had anything to say about Thanksgiving. I didn't think I had anything to be thankful for. But now everything has changed, not just politically, but personally as well. And this is all about family, and you don't have to be blood related to be family with somebody. And this year, more than any year that I could remember, we have a lot to be happy about and a lot to be thankful for. And for the first time in a long time, I actually get to take that concept seriously.
Well, it's amazing to be able to have you here, and it's to everyone, it's such an important time. We're entering into the holiday season, so with Christmas coming up, or Yule, depending on what your traditions are. It's a great time to be able to remember that we're entering into this cycle of where we're in the harvest, and we are reaping. We're reaping what's been sowed for what the nationalist movement has been planting for years, and we're just starting to reap what we've sowed for so, so long. And the harvest isn't done yet, but, you know, we're coming into this cycle of where, of course, in winter, everything goes in seasons, and there's going to be a cleansing. I mean, that's really what winter is. And then there's going to be a rebirth. So this should encourage us for 2017, of where we're going from here, that after this winter, where we're going to be able to build more infrastructure, build more unity, be able to plan events, plan charity, plan all these things we're going to be doing in 2017, and of course, all the politics around the world, whether it's the elections in France or the referendum coming up in Italy, all these different things, we are going to be reaping so much, there's not going to be enough storehouses to be able to put all of the great wins that we're reaping. I mean, we're over here, we're wind farmers right now, and we're running out of space. There's too many wins. We need a new combine because there's so many wins to take in. But to get on to some of the things that are going on today, Dr. Johnson, of course, you've got several different hats. You've got your PhD hat, and then you've got your incense-laden Orthodox hat, of course. And I want to talk about something, you know, because I was raised Catholic. I know you were raised Catholic. Most of us who are Orthodox in America, if you're not ethnically born into it, were raised Catholic. And one of the big reasons that drove me from the Catholic Church was the liberalism that I saw within it, where these sacred things that I was told that were so important were just being discarded. And of course, when I started doing historical research, I couldn't reconcile Pope Urban II saying that we shall go and fight that vile race that is, you know, attacking the Christians in the East, and then be washing their feet, and things have changed. But one of the last issues that the Catholic Church in America, and again, I love all my Catholic comrades, I know Catholic priests, I actually just talked about this yesterday, who are amazing people, who are traditionalists. I was just watching a video from a Falangist rally in Spain that just went up yesterday. And of course, they had clergy there who were blessing and doing the Roman salute with the crowd and singing Carl Soul, you know, Face the Sun. And there are good people. And we're talking about an institution of over a billion people. There are hundreds of millions of good Catholics out there. The problem is the Jewish-controlled Vatican. And it's just like our media. Having a media is not a bad thing. Having a bank is not a bad thing. But when you have a Jewish-controlled institution, it becomes anti-traditional, it's anti-national, and it's anti-Christ, I mean, in all seriousness. And we see now that Pope Francis is telling Catholics worldwide that, that priests now can absolve the faithful of abortion. Women, and this is the key thing right here, and health workers, as the New York Times has reported, so we mean abortion doctors. We can forgive these priests, your local parish priests, can forgive abortion doctors, those that have committed over 3,000 murders of the unborn per day in the United States, per day, close to 60 million unborn lives killed. And simply from, you know, I take it from a spiritual perspective, where all life is sacred, but even from a white nationalist perspective, if you wanted to be a secularist, we're talking about tens of millions of white children that didn't get to come into this world, and we're talking about demographics. So no matter where you stand on the issue in terms of faith, we're talking about tens of millions of our brothers and sisters killed not at the Somme or Verdun or Normandy, but in clinics and Planned Parenthoods all across the United States and across the Western world. So this is a radical change. The Catholic Church was, you know, good on the pro-life issue for a very long time. And now this special permission that Pope Francis gave during this Holy Year of Mercy that he had for the Catholic Church is now making this standard policy of where you can forgive abortion doctors for being murderers. And of course, I believe in repentance. I believe that, you know, to repent in the Greek is to turn away from. So if you are a former abortion doctor and you realize the horrendous things that you've done, I believe that you can be redeemed. And then, you know, like the woman in Roe v. Wade actually is a radical pro-lifer. She speaks, you know, she had an abortion. She's regretted it for decades. And she speaks at every Right to Life march in D.C. every single January, to be able to speak out against it. So that is repentance. That is good. I'm not against people repenting. But this is a radical change of policy. So, Dr. Johnson, to kick into to Father Johnson territory for a second, what is going on?
Well, first of all, my very first issue in this field, the first two were abortion and the facts. And my primary comment is that it was never the Old and the New Testaments that got me against all of this. I don't need to be religious to realize that abortion is wrong and that homosexuality is perversion. Natural law was sufficient to tell me that. Every pagan society that ever existed up until recently was opposed to this kind of behavior. And so it's not really a religious question concerning abortion. The second thing is the way that this is written. It was always possible, as you already hinted at, it was always the case that when you repent, even these people can be forgiven, and we have an obligation to forgive them. That's what he's saying here, but that's not really what he's saying here. Why would he state something that he already believes, something that's already obvious to any Christian anywhere? No, what he's saying here is that it's an acceptable practice, because it was never in doubt that you can absolve these people when they're repentant, and they can't go back to do it anymore. No, he's saying that's obvious. But what he's saying here is something deeper than that. That this is acceptable. This is something that the Church of Rome is going to accept from here on in. Now, the third point is you may have good, maybe millions and millions is a bit much, but you may have plenty of good Catholics out there who are traditionalists and nationalists. The problem is the central concept with the Catholic Church is the Pope of Rome. Everything that the Roman Church is the papacy. Now you have the papacy rejecting itself, rejecting all of its previous doctrines. Being a Roman Catholic now is a bit of a problem. Roman Catholic, the central concept, if not even the only concept in Roman Catholicism, is that the Pope is the head of the Church. When you're in communion with somebody, it means that you are of one mind with this person. That's what communion is. Not just a picture in the vestibule of the church. It's you're one person with this. And so Roman Catholics, I don't know how any Roman Catholic could remain one, unless you completely repudiate this present pope. I am blown away by this guy. Every 10 minutes, there's a new outrage. He has negated the church. He's negated all doctrine. He is a complete shill. I don't envy Roman Catholics today.
Well, and that's such an interesting thing to be able to point out, because I think it's so accurate. And of course, he's appointing cardinals as quickly as he can, to be able to stack the deck so that this legacy of perverting the Catholic Church will continue long after he's dead. I mean, this is a long-term thing. And of course, we had one of the cardinals here in the United States say, no matter what Donald Trump does, they're going to try and resettle refugees and fulfill their biblical commandment. And of course, it's funny, you know, the Democrats support homosexuality. They support murder of the unborn. They support every perversion, but instantly they become a philo Roman when it comes to this pope. When talking about these things, and it just seems to me that this really is. I mean, it's the post-war period, because when you think about traditional Catholicism, like I think not just of the Crusaders or the righteous kings and queens of the Middle Ages and throughout history. I mean, I even think of like Leon de Grel, or Francisco Franco, or Jose Antonio, or Father Tiso. I mean, you had a Catholic priest as the head of a fascist state in Europe during the 1940s, and he was in full communion with Rome. I mean, Mussolini was in, and the reason the Vatican is an independent nation state is because of Mussolini. It's because of the black shirts. It was Mussolini that mandated that every Italian school have crucifixes, and he banned divorce. He worked against abortion. He worked against pornography. I mean, the concordant with the Vatican, that the NSDAP government had with the Vatican was such an important thing to be able to ensure that traditional Catholicism was able to have its full expression within Germany at the time. And everything was about traditionalism. It was about real organic values. It was about holding to the faith. And we, you know, as Orthodox Christians, can disagree with the papacy on certain issues, but it went from a place where we could at least sit down and where things were still beholden to a foundation of some sort. Now, in the post-Vatican II world, has completely been blown apart. I mean, what has so radically changed in regards to the last 50 years? Because to go from Leon de Grel having his men take confession and communion before they went into battle, being blessed by priests, the Vatican signing agreements with basically every fascist state, and then them enshrining Christianity as the moral foundation of the nation, and especially in Catholic nations, but also Orthodox nations that were liberated. How did things change so quickly?
The first thing that popped into my mind when you said that is that, you know, the Rothschild family is the banker of the Vatican. And a lot of the Vatican's money is in the Rothschild coffers. This was always the case, where, especially in North Italy, where the papal banker was the Medici's in Florence. This goes back a long time, where the elite banker ends up being the chief banker for the Vatican. I think that has everything to do with it. And the implication of this is that when liberal Orthodox around the world want to get involved ecumenically with Roman Catholics, don't think that this is some, you know, Latin mass tradition from 200 years ago. These are clown masses and
hoverboard masses.
Yeah, hoverboard man, Darth Vader masses and everything. This is what these Orthodox want to be in communion with. When I was growing up, this stuff, you know, this is like in the late 70s, that this stuff didn't exist, but the foundations were. Now, when I was Roman Catholic in grad school, I was SSPX for a while. I suppose the only group that really could function now would be the Sedevacantists, many of whom I know. Problem with Sedevacantists is that it eliminates the main bulwark of the church, or the Pope of Rome. The problem with Sedevacantism is it means that the laity can now judge the Pope, reversing, you know, the centuries of Roman Catholic tradition, where because the buck stops there, no one can judge the Pope. If you can judge the Pope, then you're back to Orthodoxy again with the rest Western Rite. So at the very least, the one group of Catholics I have any real standing now are the Sedevacantists. At least they reject this Pope, and I don't think it will be too far. Pretty soon they'll go to the final a conclusion of that, and then rejecting the papacy as this infallible person.
Well, and you know, to bring in as an Orthodox thing, I mean, as I'm sitting here and looking at my icons that are on my icon wall, You know, becoming being Catholic and becoming Orthodox. I mean, that's one of the big things that, that brought me to Orthodoxy when I got back to the Great Schism of 1054. And then you look at that and you go, based on the first millennia of Christianity, the Orthodox were correct. They just were, and the papacy asserted powers it didn't have. And I don't like to get into factionalism. Again, I love all comrades who are fighting, but I think this is an important discussion for us to be able to bring to the forefront. Why aren't there more Western Rite Orthodox? I'm going to be critical of our side here for a second, because we need to be introspective. And I think we have dramatically failed. It's like when Father Martin Luther justifiably revolted against things that he saw in Rome, where he saw the German people were being milked for all their money. It was being stolen from them, told that they were going to buy their grandma out of hell to be able to go and fund lavish orgy parties in the Vatican and things like this. He was rebelling against things, I think, justifiably. I've got a tremendous amount of respect for Father Luther. I don't agree with everything he said, but I think he was a good Christian man. He was a good Christian priest that was doing what he thought was right. And I know he was communicating with the Orthodox world, but the problem was a language barrier, primarily, where he didn't speak Greek, and that was an issue, and they didn't speak German. They might be able to speak Latin, and it was very difficult for communication. Things were going on in the Orthodox world dealing with the Muslims, so things didn't go anywhere. But why isn't there a stronger presence of Orthodoxy in the West? Because by all accounts, there should be a huge and thrive, and we are growing. We're growing very quickly, but when we're so a small thing, our numbers are still very small. Why isn't there a bigger presence in Western Europe and the United States? And is it our fault? And I'm going to say that, let's be honest for a second. I think the Orthodox world has failed Western Europe and America with not doing proper outreach. I want to know your thoughts on that.
Well, the first concept is, when I first read the Old Testament, my thought was, why in the hell were these people chosen? The entire Old Testament is nothing but condemnations of Israel and completely failing its mission. I say the same thing about Orthodoxy. Why this bunch? The main issue is factionalism. Orthodox people, if they don't have something to fight about, will invent something to fight about. The name worship issue is something that they invented to create factions. And when factions come into existence, the first thing they do is create more factions. That's the first thing. It is destructive. And these bishops and these people who do this are going to have to pay. And I do not envy them when they die. That's the first thing. The second thing is, Western Rite is very important. There is a true Western Rite coming from 9th century Northumbria, Britain, that has been translated. That's legitimate. It has a lot of Byzantine elements to it. It's a completely Orthodox service. But Western Rite today, coming from Antioch, is the Anglican service with no changes. They have statues, they have organs, they have unleavened bread, they venerate post-schism saints, and they pretend to be Orthodox. So I thought the Western Rite was a joke, until I came across the actual one that very few people even know about. The third thing is, when the Russian exiles came to America after the Russian Civil War, they were extremely paranoid, with good reason. They were extremely traumatized. They never learned to speak English. They were frightened of outsiders. The KGB was trying to infiltrate their groups. And so they were a disaster when it came to political activity. They never even learned the English language. They couldn't communicate. They didn't want to communicate with anybody else. And so there was no outreach there at all, partially because of their very specific situation, scared of infiltration and things like that. And finally, it's very esoteric. It's very hard. It's not the simple legalism like the Roman Church would be, or the, salvation, the easy salvation of most of the Protestants. It's extremely difficult to get deep into the mystical tradition and make any sense out of it. So those, I think, are just the introductory reasons as to why Orthodoxy continues to struggle, not only in the Western world, but in the Eastern world, too.
Well, and when it comes to the folk traditions, and I think it's so important. I mean, we've talked about it before, but when the folks came to convert the United Kingdom, to convert England and Ireland and such, they were told that the understandings of our folkish customs, if they didn't conflict with Christianity, were a way to be able to understand the natural world. It was a beautiful thing. So, I mean, we're Thanksgiving's on Thursday. So, of course, that means Friday is the beginning of the Christmas season. It gets, earlier every year. But things like when you put a wreath on your door or when you bring a tree in and things like that, where we as Christians are worshiping the birth of Christ. It's such a beautiful Christian thing. But at the same time, having these folk traditions are an important thing. And I think where Protestantism, I mean, whether, with Calvinism and things like that, where you get rid of all the folkish elements of your expression, it just becomes very cold, because our folk traditions are part of our living experience and our people's living experience in understanding God and relating to God, and each people in each culture is different. I mean, that's what the nations are. We're separate peoples. It's not just blood, but it's culture and customs and things like that. But there does seem to be a war, whether, you know, if you convert to Orthodoxy in the United States, there's kind of a push, you know, if you join a Russian church to learn Russian customs, or a Greek church to learn Greek customs, which all those are great. One is not better than the other. But I think that we've kind of had a failure when it comes to understanding what our folkish Western European traditional customs were that our ancestors practiced as Christians before the schism, post-schism, and now things have kind of gone off the rails a little bit. But what do you think we can do to be able to better integrate a more organic expression of Christianity that is 100% Orthodox in theology, but is unique to us?
The traditional Western rite that exists in this country goes back not only to early medieval Britain, but also Ireland and Gaul. Understanding the traditions there, for example, to be Russian Orthodox is not to have a Russian ethnicity. That's never what it is. It's to accept the customs of the church that have its origin in the area around Moscow. That's really what that means. The folk traditions are really what being human is. Being human is to take this cold, angry, unforgiving world and to put our stamp on it. It is perfectly healthy. It's in accordance with natural law. Every once in a while you get something weird, you know, that has to go, but even most pagans would agree with that. You had mentioned the conversion of Britain. Gregory the First and his instructions to St. Augustine said, essentially there is no religion of paganism. There is a set of folk customs that for the most part are healthy. This is what makes a people a people. Mm-hmm. Only if they're doing something, a practice that's outrageously immoral, then you may say something about it. Otherwise, leave it there. Folk customs, are usually in accordance with that, but this is what human beings do. We take this world and we make it some kind of a home. And that's all we're talking about here. When the Protestants said we're going to not eliminate paganism, whatever that is. I still don't know what a pagan is. For years I've been trying to find out. There is no doctrine. There are no pagan heretics. So I don't really know what it is, except that this is this adherence to these folk traditions, which you can't be human without them. When the Protestant Reformation came into existence, they eliminated all intermediaries between God and man. It could be the saints, it could be the church itself. And that meant everything went, because culture is an intermediary. Mm-hmm. Plato's forms were intermediaries. And the only thing that happened was that the state became all powerful. That was the only institution left. And everywhere the Protestants went, from England to Germany, you had very strong states, princes who ran everything, and then the religion became the domain of the government. When you eliminate all these intermediaries, including folk traditions, that's all you have left.
Well, I mean, that's like in Orthodoxy, you know, the symbol, of course, of the two-headed eagle, you know, where one head is the church, one head is the state, and the body is the folk, the body is the people, and you can't cut off one head and have the other survive. It's all linked together, and then like an eagle, it flies and rises together, and everything must work in harmony. I mean, natural law, I mean, if you get down to it, you know, with what were our pagan ancestors understanding, it was understanding natural law. It was being able to put that understanding and encoding that understanding for people throughout generations to understand these very deep things that, you know, your average peasant, you know, in 500 BC understood more on a deep level than our most talented scientists do today. Because these are truths about the essence of nature, about natural law, about the harmony of creation. These understandings are so powerful. And you know, of course, science has turned totally secular in the worst possible way, where the natural law is completely ignored. But so what can we do? Because I don't, you know, there's always been religious infighting within the nationalist cause. And I think that's a great misfortune. But, you know, what I think we've all talked about is that there is no conflict, because our values and our beliefs support our folk customs and these rituals and understandings within a 100% Orthodox theological framework. And that if someone is not Orthodox, but as you know, following natural law, then they're trying to follow truth. I mean, that's what Plato and Aristotle and all the great pagan philosophers were doing. We're trying to understand truth. So, what would you say, you know, to people who, you know, we have listeners of a variety of backgrounds who might be pagan, different Christian denominations, things like that, that might want to fight each other? I don't think that there is a conflict whatsoever. And I think we should be able to really treat each other as family, because at the root of things, to love your brother, to be able to, you know, those, you know, scripture tells us that if you, you know, those that don't care for their, those of their own house are worse than an unbeliever. So as a Christian, you have a duty to your brothers and sisters of your, who are your kinsmen, who are your blood. And we're tied together through cultural and natural law. So does there need to be infighting? Does there need to be a conflict?
There's never any reason to fight. The only time we fight is when we're dealing with actual enemies, people who want to subvert our traditions, want to subvert the Western world, want to start wars needlessly with different parts. This is why we fight. We have enough fighting with actual enemies. I didn't think we would have the energy left to fight each other. Truth and falsehood does exist in the religious realm. But given the crisis situation that we're in, fighting with each other, I mean, the Orthodox world was so bad that even under the communists, the underground church, the catacomb church, their very first synod, which had to move from place to place because they were frightened of being found out, even they were anathematizing each other. Even then, they were in the gulags, literally sitting in gulag cells, screaming at each other, anathematizing each other for very minor issues. There's something in the psyche here where you take this concept of truth so far that you absolutely have to dominate everybody else. And even the underground church in the gulags, or threatened to go to the gulags, were anathematizing each other over fairly minor issues. There's something about coming to this truth. And remember, too, the demons care about one thing. They don't care about anybody else but who has the truth and who's following that. The natural law is anathema to the demons. When I came across the Stoics, Plato for the first time, all I saw was natural law. Natural law has to come from somewhere. So it wasn't really that big of a jump to go from the more impersonal world of Plato and Cicero to jump to the more personal world of Christianity, especially in the early church. So no, there isn't a conflict here if you understand it properly. If you understand this with a historical mentality, no, the cooperation is the only thing that makes any sense. And we'll find out, I think, at the end, that we have far more in common than otherwise.
Well, and that's such an important thing, I think, and to be able to, again, I mean, give thanksgiving for one another. And, you know, I've stood, on the picket line with people who are different Christian denominations, different confessions, folk religionists, you know, people who are truth seekers, but aren't really within a religious framework or a philosophical framework, but they're seeking truth. And at the end of the day, we're all fighting for our people. We want our people to be able to survive. We want this world to survive. And we're seeking truth. And I think, if you're seeking truth, you're going to come to Orthodoxy. I'm truly convinced of that. I've done it. I've got a lot of friends that have done it. But we're all on the same path. I mean, St. Paul told us to run the race, you know, and the race is towards truth. Because as a Christian, if God is truth, then if you're striving for truth, then you're eventually going to find God. So I don't think we're in conflict whatsoever. Of course, it doesn't mean sacrificing our principles or our theology. But working towards understanding truth is understanding natural law. And natural law means we are all in this together. We are all one extended family. And we're fighting for our children. So, Dr. Johnson, give us your final thought for the day as we send off our listeners.
We, like you, I was in the picket line as a young man in college and later on protesting abortion, homosexuality. We had every conceivable person on there, every background you can imagine. We're not going to have a religious test here. You can't have a picket sign unless you sign this doctrinal statement. Mm-hmm. We're fighting for the same cause, and you don't know where people are in there. They're coming to the truth. You don't know where they are in that journey. It sometimes takes a long time. And the last thing you do to convert anybody, screaming and yelling at them and calling them names, is not going to have them say, "Oh, I had no idea how wrong I was. I'm a jerk." Then it all goes. That's that. You have to explain. You have to love them into it before they do anything. And you have to show by example. This is how you convert people. Not by putting a finger in their face, as I used to do many years ago. Very, very, very poor. It's a very bad tactic if you want to convert anybody.
Well, love one another. I mean, that's the commandment. Whether you're talking about our folk traditions, whether you're talking about Christianity, is love. God is love, and we must love one another as an extended family. Give thanks for one another, and be able to stand together. So, Dr. Johnson, thank you so much for being here today. Thank you so much, ladies and gentlemen, and I'm going to look forward to being back tomorrow with Sven for another edition of The Daily Traditionalist. So everyone, have a great rest of your day, and hail victory!
You've been tuned into The Daily Traditionalist with Matthew Heimbach at RadioArea.com.